To approach the problem of mythology and its relevance to contemporary life within 3 weeks of the moonwalk really sets up the problem in a very emphatic way. It was 426 years before that Copernicus announced the heliocentric universe, 1543. That was the first cosmological concept that was not based on the visual experience of man on Earth. And it separated our intellectual understanding of the cosmos from our visual experience of it and made inevitable the ultimate coming into manifestation of the mythology, or rather the field within which mythology must operate, which came into being on July 20th of this year. Now, that heliocentric universe is something that has been visually experienced by hundreds of thousands of people. And all of your children are going to take it for granted. This extension of earthly experience to what were formerly thought to be totally different cosmic bodies simply brings before us all what Galileo worked out when he applied the principles of ballistics and the movements of propelled bodies on Earth to an interpretation of the orbits of the planets and other heavenly spheres. Now, as you all undoubtedly remember, the Inquisition roundly, thoroughly, and explicitly condemned the heliocentric universe as being contrary to scriptures and consequently untrue. This was done quite clearly and emphatically. Luther also condemned Copernicus as simply a clown trying to refute scripture. Well, what we can say now is that the scriptural interpretation of mythology has been completely refuted by these events. It stunned me to hear on Christmas Eve from three men circumnavigating the moon those words from the first verses of the book of Genesis, which everyone whom I've talked to felt were immensely moving, coming from that distance in the beginning and all that sort of thing. Based on a cosmology inherited from the Sumerians of the 4th millennium BC, with a three-layered universe with waters beneath, waters above, and the firmament separating these. We had just heard from the three explorers that the moon was very dry. There was no water up there at all. And then they went on with this. Now, this discontinuity between the religious heritage and those epithets and phrases and images which are driven into us in childhood, so that when they come up later they stir the whole range of our nature with a sense of glorious poetry, are so far out of touch with our own cosmological knowledge that one could only say that when mythological symbols are interpreted in that manner, they simply are being misinterpreted. And the first point I want to make is that one of the great problems of our relationship to the mythological imagery is that they have been consistently interpreted in historical, geographical, and cosmological terms. And we now have refuted all of those interpretations. And so the imagery of our mythological heritage has been disqualified for us. It seems not to be of any real relevance to contemporary life. a point that I want to bring up in these talks, and which I think will help to make all of this work for us, is that the origin of the mythological symbols is not pseudo-scientific, pseudo-historical. They spring from the psyche. They are not the consequence of observations. They are the consequence of observations misinterpreted through projections from the human psyche. And these symbols, which are of great significance psychologically, have, as a consequence of their interpretation as history and cosmology, been taken away from us. They no longer are working. From my point of view, the imagery of myth is the imagery through which our own nature, our unconscious nature, communicates with our consciousness. And they have in the past, when the symbols have been received simply and naively, without criticism, operated to keep the conscious programs and life in touch with the unconscious motivations. But when these symbols are removed, as they have been for us, there takes place a disconnection. We hear all over the place these days of alienation. And in terms of the concerns of my science and thinking, one can interpret this alienation as the consequence of the loss of those vehicles or instruments of communication by which we would have kept our consciousness in touch with our own root nature. And then we seek the nature in other ways, going back into the country, or becoming, as it were, primitives, or one way or another, leaving the world of our civilization to go back and find roots, as though those roots are outside. The roots are really inside, and they can be found by way of these, of a restoration, a reactivation of the real communication which these symbols originally rendered. Now let us, I've spoken of the discontinuity between the Christmas message and the fact of those men flying around the moon. Just about the time they were delivering that message, they had delivered also one of the most stunning pictures I think a modern intellect could have tried to accommodate itself to, namely the Earthrise over the moon. This was even more stunning than the image of the Earth, which they had taken at this, that, and the next distance. But this business of another plane for the human eye and mind to rest upon and see its own Earth coming up and realize that we are on this bubble floating around the cosmos. There we got it. Now our children are getting it, and it's no longer a merely intellectual concept of a heliocentric universe played against the experience of the senses. It is now an experience of the senses. That fantastic movie, 2001, which I'm sure a number of you have seen, of this space journey into the field of the planet Jupiter, I think. I was sitting in a theater when I saw this with a lot of kids around me. They knew everything that was going on there. They could name what this and the other element was, which for me was a novelty. For them, it's as much the ground of their basic human experience as for us getting into an automobile and out again. So another field of images has come in. Mythologies that operate, that function, and are vital are always up to date scientifically. They represent an integration of the experience of the environment with the experiencing subject, the psyche of the local individuals. But when the science has moved away from the cosmology of the mythology. The mythology is dead, and our traditional mythologies are, for most of us, utterly dead. And all one has to do is see and know something of the confusion of the various clergies to realize this. They are in full retreat and greatly disturbed about the problem. I remember hearing a story years ago of an old lady who looked at the moon through a telescope and then said, "Give me the moon the way God made it." Now we just have to ask what God that was that made the moon as she knew it. And that was the God of this refuted biblical cosmology. But this doesn't mean that the imagery of the biblical tradition or any other archaic tradition is refuted. What is refuted is the cosmological interpretation of it. When I started as a young scholar teaching courses on comparative mythology, my ambition was to break down the religions of my students. And I found that the results of my teaching were exactly the opposite to what my intention was. Their religions were already either broken down or non-existent, and the experience of the meanings of the symbols sort of reactivated their heritages for them and put them back in touch, you might say, with the rich traditions out of which they had come. Now, let us, in order to do this thing systematically, review what might be said to be the leading functions of mythology. This is an elementary point. It's the ABCs of the whole subject. What are the functions that mythology has served? How many of these can be served today? And those that are not being served by our mythological heritage are being served by some other aspect of our heritage, and let's try to see what it is. The first function, one might say, of every mythology has always been a mystical, metaphysical function. That of awakening in the mind and spirit of the individuals a sense of awe before the mystery of being itself. This is the mystery dimension. And the first function of mythology is to communicate that so that in the field of mythological forms and of the rites by which those you participate in those forms, you are made aware experientially of the ultimate absolute mystery of the universe, which cannot be caught in words. It absolutely transcends all conceptualizations, and it breaks past all fields of meaning. The world, the universe, life, being itself, is absolutely without meaning. It is antecedent to meaning. Meanings are the mental interpretations, and these vary. These are what vary. The meanings given. Now, not only the universe itself, but also the imagery of myth is intrinsically without meaning. It is a being statement. And the experience of the, you know, getting turned on or the ripple or buzz comes when all of your meaning interpretations smash, break up. And what has been called the mysterium tremendum et fascinans, the fascinating, tremendous mystery of this whole thing, comes zooming through. Now, it is a tremendous mystery. And it's an appalling, monstrous mystery. Just think of the nature of life itself. It lives on life. The prime image of life is this consuming monster, which would not be there if it were not consuming life. That's the sense of the image of the Ouroboros consuming its own tail and eating itself. There's a fantastic Indian myth of this great deity Shiva. He has three eyes, you know. This is the eye of inner knowledge, but also thunder power. And Shiva was approached by a monster who demanded possession of Shiva's consort, Parvati. And Shiva, in a moment of great wrath, simply let a blast go forth from this eye, and there materialized was a monster avid to eat, to consume. Well, monster number one was one-upmanshiped by this second monster, and appalled by what confronted him, he threw himself at Shiva's feet, throwing himself on the god's mercy. Well, now in metaphysical, ethics, when that happens, the god, of course, has to protect. So, being asked to protect, the god did indeed protect. So, well, monster number two says, well, what about it? You brought me forth simply as a creature of hunger. What shall I do now? Whom shall I eat? So Shiva had a brilliant thought. He says, eat yourself. So the deity did. He started with his hands and feet, and he went right up the line. And Shiva looked at this with great satisfaction. And finally, all that was left was the face. Now this face, Shiva said, this is utterly admirable, and I'm going to have this face as the guardian of my temples. And you'll see in many Indian temples, this strange mask with tusks but no chin, he's already eaten that much, and it's just what's left on top there as a symbol of what life is. And this is called Kirti Mukha, which means shining face, the wonderful face of glory. This is a symbol of life. This is the ultimate thing about it. It's a monster. It's an avid, grabbing, eating, self-consuming thing. Life is a self-consuming monster. Well, now, the sensitive intellect becomes aware of this. Now, this has been in being for something like 2 billion years before any sensitive intellect's eyes opened and saw what was going on. Meanwhile, the possessor of this sensitive intellect has himself grown up in his mother's womb, is born with a lot of organs, already avid for what their various duties are, and he starts to work to try to interpret these and to correct them according to his own sensitive understanding of what should be. This is what is known as alienation. This person is alienated from his own character, his own nature, so that one of the functions of myth has always been to reconcile consciousness to this monstrous thing which is the precondition of its own existence. This involves rites, particularly on the primitive level, that are absolutely appalling. The whole thing is demonstrated right before you there, and you are to be enthusiastically participating, saying, this is what I am doing. Now, of course, when we relegate all of the horror part of our existence to special little areas like slaughterhouses and so forth, so that all we get is the beautiful, delicious dinner that we got tonight, didn't have to go out and eat that animal alive in the fields, we may feel no real impact of the horror of our own existence, what it implies for other beings. The primary mythologies are absolutely affirmative of this. I've been reading and thinking of myths for a long, long time, and I cannot think of a single, what we call primitive or primary mythology, that is negative to this. And the initiation rites of young boys, they render the experience both on the boy himself and in what he sees. Some of the Australian rites are almost incredible. What those kids go through when they're 12, 11, 13 years old. One of the more unappetizing aspects is this of the older men bleeding themselves, and the boys live for weeks on men's blood. They're weaning them from woman's food, the mother milk. And the boys, along with the men's blood, are receiving manly wisdom. The mythology is communicated through this. The woman gives birth to a nature being. The men's blood gives birth to a culture being. someone who has been integrated in the culture heritage, but always in the way of these horror experiences and the infliction upon the boys of what for, I think, most of us would be practically unendurable pain. However, at a certain time in human history, and the date is somewhere around the 7th century BC, we begin to get evidence of strong negative reactions to this. The prime word is from Schopenhauer that epitomizes this attitude. Life is something that should not have been. It's a mistake, a cosmic error. And when this comes, we get a system of myths having to do with withdrawing from it all. Now, these are the two primary mythological orientations. That of affirmation with gratitude, with joy in participation, with rapture. And that of absolute withdrawal. The third position is that of correction. Now, this mythology of correction, which is the one that most of us inherit, is characteristic, and I think, as far as my own understanding of all these things goes, local to the Near East. The earliest example of it in the records is in Zoroastrianism, the Persian religion of Zoroaster. This is a new thing in the history of mythology. The dating of Zoroaster is extremely obscure and uncertain. There are two main theses. There are always two theses for anything in the scientific world. One is that he should be dated somewhat early, perhaps 1100 BC, and the other is somewhat late, somewhere around 600 BC. There are reasons for this, which I won't go into now. Both of them are very convincing arguments. In any case, it is in the period of Darius, the great Darius the First, about 525 to 486 BC, that with the establishment of the great reach of the Persian Empire, that this religion becomes the imperial religion of ancient Persia. The basic thesis is this, that the prime creator created an absolutely good world, a world of pure light, consequently an invisible world. Of course, to have anything visible, you have to have light and shade. So this wonderfully pure, invisible world was the world of absolute perfection in its first creation. The Lord of Light, Ahura Mazda, is the creator of this world. Then comes the negative power, the antagonist, the teacher of the lie. And he, jealous, attacks this world and renders it light and dark. There is a prime good creation, then a fall. This is the fall. And it is as a result of that fall that the world of visible things comes into being. I say, in contrast to the biblical story, where you have the world first and then the fall, the world itself is a production of the fall. And the fall is not blamed on man. It is prehistoric. In the absolute sense, it is before historic time comes into being that the fall took place. Now, the world as it exists then is a world of the interplay of light and dark. These two great powers, Ahura Mazda and Angra Mainyu, the dark, are in counterplay in the world as it exists. And each of us is invited to participate in the battle of the gods on the side of Ahura Mazda, to eradicate evil and assist in the restoration of the good world. This is a thesis that brings in the concept of a progressive history taking place, and you are invited to participate in that history. This religion, the notion that the world can be improved, the notion that we are improving it, the notion that it is precisely this society, this community, this religion that is the improving one, leads to a kind of progressivism, but also to an imperialism. This power is imposing its will on all other powers, and doing all the things of horror which have to be done in order to be alive at all, it is nevertheless moving toward the elimination of these conditions. Now, this is the thesis that comes into the Old Testament in the formula of the fall and redemption. It's just about contemporary with the Zoroastrian movement, and the relationship of the biblical to the Zoroastrian is not really known. They're in exactly the same area, the same field. As you all know, it was the Persian Cyrus who restored the Hebrews to Jerusalem after the Babylonian captivity and so forth. Isaiah the second Isaiah, celebrates Cyrus the Great, the antecedent of Darius, as the almost Messiah of the Lord Jehovah, and that Jehovah had been his inspiration and so forth and so on. So these two are very closely related. However, in the biblical tradition, the blame is put on man instead of on a cosmic force, and this sense that in living the life that we have to live in order to be human beings at all, we are somehow in exile, which was brought on by man himself, is another inflection of this thesis of the Zoroastrians. Then this comes down into Christianity as well, and we have the whole theme of fall and redemption through Christ, and the movement then toward the second coming, which is also there in Zoroastrianism, when the lion will lie down with the lamb. And that wasn't very good, will not be very good for lions or anything having to do with the lionine in human or other nature. So we have these three approaches to this first mystery, this first function of mythology, relating man to the ultimate mystery of existence. One, the affirmative one of the prime mythology. Second, the negative one of the world-rejecting mythologies, which has its strongest statement in Jainism in India. Jainism and certain aspects of ascetic Hinduism and Hinayana Buddhism. These are the prime religions of this absolute negation. The world cannot be corrected and must be just rejected. There is also a very strong strain of this in certain aspects of Gnosticism, which come along very strongly in the first centuries B.C. and the first five centuries A.D., and then has a resurgence in the medieval period in the Albigensian tradition of Europe. Then there is the third mythological approach to this first function of reconciling consciousness with the world, that namely of the restoration of a perfect life which will not have the characteristics of the life in which we live. So that in this tradition, what we take to be life is regarded as simply a prelude to a total transformation of the world and of human life through the activities, usually, of a single community, a church, a race, a nation. The second function, then, of all mythologies, the first, I've said, is this metaphysical, mystical function of relating consciousness to the preconditions of its own existence, either positively, negatively, or in the way of correction. The second function is the cosmological function. This is the one that has been taken over for us by science. It always was in the hands of science. Only proto-science is not as exact as ours, but nevertheless, in their own day, essentially scientific, based on objective observation and drawing conclusions from what was observed. We can point to three great stages, actually, in the development of these cosmological concepts. First, we have the basic non-literate primitive traditions. For these people, the prime themes in the mythologies have to do with the extraordinary in experience. Not the norms of experience, but what is extraordinary. The coyote or the beaver that doesn't act quite like other coyotes or beavers. The one that has an exceptional quality. The rock that has a curious, fascinating difference about it. The tree that stands differently from others. Those exceptional experiences. However, with the emergence in the Near East, in the 9th millennium BC, of societies based on agriculture, where a large community, and an increasingly large community, established in one place, could grow up, with other possibilities in life besides that simply of questing for one's food, the observations of the heavens became more and more consistent and accurate. By the 4th millennium BC, little cities began to emerge in Mesopotamia. Ur, Uruk, Erech, Nippur, and so forth, a whole little constellation. And it was in these cities that, because of their size, a differentiation of human functions came into being. In a primitive community, all the adults are in complete control of the nature of the culture heritage. They are equivalent adults. In a city community, you have specialists, professional priests, professional governing people and bureaucrats. You have professional trading people, professional peasants, servants of different sorts, so that you have a constellation of people of different types. And the problem of the culture is to integrate all these in the sense of being one community, one being. The professional priests in the 4th millennium BC, you can think of the date 3500 BC as the approximate one for this, were the originators of writing, of mathematics, based on the decade and on the sexagesimal system of the 60s, which we still use for measuring circles, whether circles of space or circles of time. And it was they, through observation of the heavens, who first recognized the movements of the planets at a fixed, mathematically determined rate through the constellations of the fixed stars. This concept of an impersonal mathematical order was the first concept of a cosmological consistency that mankind had ever conceived of, and this was the moment fascinating of that period. That concept of a cosmic order, to which the human order ought to adapt itself. And so we have this fantastic charade of human beings pretending to be planets. The king wearing the sign of the sun, or of the moon, whichever the dominant male divinity happened to be in that culture town. The members of his court wearing garments that simulated the garments of the heavens. The court procedure, highly hieratic. And the most fantastic thing, at certain conjunctions of planets, an eon was regarded as having ended, and the king and his entire court were killed. It was in the 20s that Sir Leonard Woolley, excavating the Sumerian city of Ur, which was the city of the moon god, came upon graves where the whole court had been buried alive. The king and his court. The queen, this is the basis of Suti, following the king, as the planet Venus follows the moon or the sun in descent as the evening star, and then as the morning star leads him out again. This is the main idea of Suti, that the wife as the planet Venus, and on the Suti stones in India, celebrating women who have become Suti, as the Indians say, you see the hand, that's the hand of the planet Venus, the symbol of Venus, who has gone to resurrect her husband and bring eternal life to both of them, the round again. This concept of the human society imitating the heavenly society, we still follow in our rituals. Our religious feasts are based on the calendar. This concept then of a society following the cosmic society comes into being. That is the dominant cosmology of all of the high religions, East and West. Now in our world today, this moon trip that I'm speaking about, the basis for that cosmology has been knocked absolutely out. Our little sun. One member of a galaxy of which the Milky Way is the rim. 100,000 light years it would take to pass through that galaxy. And this little sun is revolving like a planet in that great swing of this revolving multitude of stars. And then one looks and sees a certain kind of fuzzy-looking star, and the astronomer tells you that is another galaxy, and then another. And something like a billion galaxies have been identified, and this prodigious universe is out there. It's another world. Furthermore, the agricultural base, Mother Earth and all that, of the earlier societies, which was the base of human civilization from about the 9th millennium BC up to our own lifetimes, is now erased. This is an age of mechanizations. And these little horizons, even the horizon of China, the horizon of India, the horizon of Rome, were little horizons compared with what we have now. There are no horizons now. There is no such thing as a bounded world anymore. The communist world, this reactionary bunch of stupid people, are trying to bound their world. They have machine guns to see to it that the world is bounded, and Berlin walls. This is an attempt to restore something that's no longer possible. The open horizon, the open world, the letting things in, the trying somehow to get your laws to accommodate all the various new things that are pouring in. Just think what's come into the domain of what used to be European law. We have Asia, we have Africa, we have the tiny little cultural centers of the Micronesian islands, all with claims. So that we have mini-states as well as macro-states now, each with its claims and laws trying to encompass this, instead of liquidating those that don't correspond to a fixed system. And this, I say, is a transformation as great as that of the moon transformation. My thought is that just as from the old cosmologies of the simple tribal peoples, there was an enormous step to the vast cosmologies of the monumental cultures. So we are right now experiencing in our own lifetime a step as great from the monumental to the mechanized world, to the no horizon world, to a world that makes the multiple nature of old Hellenistic civilization look very simple. This is the challenge of the time, not to erase people and not to push them down, but to let them in and have this multiple play. And in our scientific thinking, relativity. There are no absolutes. And we always have to realize this. This seems to me to be one of the mistakes of the existentialists, as though there were any such thing as existence. There is no such thing. Every being has his own experience of existence. And there is a relativity there. You can't tell me I've got to experience Camus' nausea when I don't experience it. And that he is in a superior state because everything makes him sick. Suppose you try to compare that nausea with someone else's joy in being. And we're not to say who's the higher or who's the lower here any more than we can say what's up and what's down in relation to the star Betelgeuse. The whole thing is loose. So much then for the cosmological function of mythology. These transformations have taken place, and we are in the midst of a transformation. Now, lest you feel encouraged, let me tell you that it took something like 4,000 years for the mythologies relevant to the agricultural world to achieve something like a consistency and a life-governing power. We are in the world of change. First function of mythology, well, I've called the metaphysical or mystical. Second, the cosmological, presenting an image of the universe through which the sense of the mystery will be communicated. Now, in the normal language of science, that sense of mystery is sterilized out. This does not mean that the world that science reveals to us is impotent to render mystery. I'm sure that when we think of these galaxies and all, we are aware of the mysterium tremendum in a way that goes far beyond anything represented in the Sumerian mythology that was recited to us from the moon. The third function of a traditional mythology is to validate and support a specific social order. Every one of the mythologies that has come to us has come into being in the context of a given specific society. Now those societies were for the most part pressed. There was no margin for allowance. Everybody had to conform. And the disciplines through which conformity was enforced were very serious and ruthless. To read, for instance, in the texts of the Institutes of Vishnu or the laws of Manu, the punishments that were normal for people who broke the fantastically complicated law systems of India's traditional caste heritage, just lift the hair on your head. The image of people just being broken to pieces. And this is something that in our world has been left behind. With the humanistic tradition of the Greeks, our society is revolted by such things. And there has been a consistent effort to ameliorate the punishment side of the legal and social heritage, again, releasing people in a certain way. Of course, there are moments when things move the other direction and so forth, but just looking in a big, broad way, the kind of generosity, you might say, that inhabits our laws is something that would never have occurred, and it hasn't yet occurred to anybody in the Orient. Just don't know what to make of it. The individual was being shaped on a Procrustean bed to the demands of that society. There was no allowance for what would you like to do, doctor, lawyer, Indian chief, you know, what do you want to be, Sonny? None of that. The laws are given, strictly enforced, and anyone who can't follow is liquid. To get back to the little Australian initiations, the boys that did not do as they were told, who just had ideas of their own, were killed and eaten. Well, this is one way to get rid of juvenile delinquents, but it's also a way to eliminate some creative possibilities. And these societies, as a result, were relatively static. One of the characteristics of our own humanistic tradition is that in our better moments, at any rate, we expect the individual to be critical of his society, to be critical of his teachers, to be critical of the values that he has inherited, and innovate, change, transform. I notice in our universities and other centers these days. A great enthusiasm for the guru principle. Everybody now wants a guru, and he wants his professor to be a guru. The guru is an absolute authority, and he tells you what to do, and you do it, and he is not asking you what you would like to do. This is just exactly the opposite of the direction of Occidental humanistic education. Our professors and teachers are communicators of information for the most part, and you can take that information and use it in your own way. In class, one expects a student to criticize, and we ask for essays in reply which will develop the ideas presented in terms of the student's own thinking. This is not the way things go in Orient. It's rather a thing to teach an Oriental class and have the information come back to you as though from a tape recorder that you've produced. And you will not get criticism as a teacher from the students unless your point of view differs from that of a guru whom they prefer. Then they'll give you his criticism of what you say, but you don't get that thing. Marriage. The husband and wife are provided by the family, even marriage brokers. In the newspapers in Delhi, New Delhi, today, columns of advertisements for wives. These are advertisements put in by families and by marriage brokers. And the young couple that meets is meeting for the first time. There is none of this challenge to individual judgment, individual criticism. What is it I'm going to be? What kind of husband or wife should be mine? Or who is it just sets me crazy? This doesn't matter there, the wife or husband is given. I remember Ananda K. Kumar Swami, who was a great advertiser of Indian ideals in the last generation here, was asked, well, suppose a woman's husband turns out to be a monster, how should she behave? And his answer was, just because he has forfeited the virtues of a male life, she should not forfeit those of womanhood. She must adore him, serve him as her lord. Well, there's a whole institution that I found in Bombay, instituted by a French woman married to a Parsi, to rescue girls who would come screaming. These were the outcasts of the society. The old strict society had nothing for them. No sympathy for them, nothing. Well, so the social order has changed. Mythology as the authorization of a social order, which in all the old traditions is regarded as derived from an uncriticizable authority. In the biblical tradition, that deity who is supposed to have been the creator of the universe is also the one who delivered the law on Mount Sinai. And those laws are as uncontrovertible as the laws of the universe. Similarly, in India, where you don't have the idea of a personal creator, but the idea of a universe that has been in being, has been in being, has been in being forever, those laws which are the laws of the universe are the laws of the Indian society, and these laws cannot be changed. And look at the situation of our poor Pope, who thinks that the law delivered by some miracle to him and to the church, telling us about birth and birth control, they're fixed laws. No matter what the good or evil of society as humanistic thinking may evaluate it, this is a law that has to be obeyed. Well, they were wrong with respect to the order of the universe. They may be wrong with respect to the order of the marriage bed. This, however, is a hard thing for clergies to recognize. The old social orders are broken. There are no fixed rules. Society changes. It's changing very fast. What were virtues today yesterday are the very vices of today. And so we have an open order morally. Mythology has nothing to do with this anymore. The fourth function of a traditional mythology is to carry an individual through the crises of his life, from infancy to maturity to age. Here is a function that has hardly varied through the millenniums. With the changes of cosmology, with the changes of society, the individual has nevertheless, as a human individual, always had to go through a certain curve. The first fact about the human being as an animal is that he is born 12 years too soon. Mothers will say, thank God for that. But it brings about a very difficult situation. The child is dependent for 12 years, at least, even in a primitive society. And this attitude of dependency is fixed in the psyche. What will mother say? What will daddy say? Who will help me now? What should I do? Then, at a certain crisis of puberty, the individual is expected to assume an attitude of responsibility for his actions. I am daddy. I am mother. We might say that a neurotic is a person who did not make that crossing, who in middle life is still in fear or in dependence upon a parental image and cannot assume for himself the total responsibility for his action and does not feel responsible to anybody else, except as he chooses to be. The neurotic situation presented, his first experience is dependency, flight, where's mother, where's daddy? Then he has to think, well, for heaven's sakes, I'm daddy, I'm mother, and get going. So there is this ambivalence, the pull in two directions. The function of all of the primitive rites of puberty was to carry the individual across that threshold. And insofar as our society is failing in this, because of the rejection of the rites, we have a greater problem of neurosis than any primitive or traditional society would ever have had. However, there comes a moment in midlife when the sun begins to go down. Just about the time you've learned what the society expects of you, you begin to fail in strength and competence. Furthermore, there's a younger, livelier generation coming along that is doing it better, or perhaps in our world has invented other things to do, so that everything that you have learned to do is already a matter of archaic historical interest. The problem then is, what are you going to do with this emotion, this energy, which nobody wants anymore? It goes in. The problem of the mythology is not only to carry the individual from dependency to responsibility, but also from responsibility to nobody needs me anymore. Self-sufficiency. Now, the way that this is done in most old societies is by giving the older people a sense of authority, which people may or may not take seriously. When something is to be done, you go to the elders, the Senate or something like that, and they express themselves. They take so long to do it that the thing is already done before it's done or something like that. The person has to be carried psychologically out the door. I think when I think of this, of a story I heard of the old Barnum & Bailey Circus, which used to have these great tents, you know, and they had one tent with the freaks in it. And here you would have, you know, the fat lady, the midget, the tallest man in the world, and all this kind of thing. People would pay to get in there, and they wouldn't go out. So the place was piling up with people, and nobody could think how to get rid of them. Until somebody came up with this bright idea, instead of having the sign exit up there, put up another sign, to the grand egress, and everybody would go out. You would think you were going to a certain experience, and the main thing had been accomplished. You were out. And so this is what our religions have done also. Over the door, you get a picture of where you're going, and what does it matter when you get out, whether you're any place or not? But we've got rid of the old man without him going nuts on our hands. So the mythologies have had to affect this carriage of the individual through his life. And as I've already said, in our world, there is an additional problem that comes in that second stage, the stage of responsibility. In all of the old traditions, the notion of responsibility was that the individual would become the representative of the values of the culture as they stood. Now, let me tell you a little anecdote about gurus. The guru would be the communicator of the values of the culture. The student was to accept what the guru said without criticism. The principal virtue of the student in India is Shraddha, which means perfect faith in the guru, who must be, as it were, a perfect carrier of a light that shines through. He is, as it were, a glass without any imperfection, so that the light comes beautifully through. Now, this is a story of a student who came late one day to the regular sessions, the whole day to be spent with his guru. And the guru roughly says to him, you're late, where you been? Well, I lived the other side of the river, as you know. The river is in flood today, and I couldn't ford the stream anymore, and there was no boat, so I'm late. Well, said the guru, did the river go down? Did boat come? No. Well, how did you get here? Well, I thought, my guru is my God. My guru is the vehicle of eternal light. He has erased himself, and the light comes pouring through him. I'll simply meditate on my guru, identify with my guru, and walk across the stream. So what did I do? I said, guru, 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 and here I am. Well, of course, this touched the guru deeply. And, it was something that the kind of thing he had, would have hoped for, you might say. But and then when the student went, it continued to bug him, and he thought, I've got to try this. So he goes to the river, and of course what he says is, I, and of course what happened was he drowned. Now the reason he was a guru was that he wasn't there. The spirit, the pure wind of the spirit can walk over the water, and any being who can walk over the water is a being who is not a gross object, as most of us are. Now that guru had communicated to his student the pure light. And he had received it from his guru, who had received it from his guru, who had received it from his guru, and this goes on back, back, back. That's not what we want. That's not what we ask for. That's not what we train for. We train a person to develop his imperfections, his peculiar nuances of personality and talents. That thing which was never in the world before is what we want people to become. And this brings about this troubled, certainly, greatly disturbed, but greatly productive world, in contrast with which the old worlds just seem to be petrifactions. How can a society survive when it's asking people to be individuals? This is the great problem, sociologically, psychologically. The problem, and this is one of our mythological problems, the imagery that will enable a person to develop himself without violating the requirements of the society. In the old world, there was an exact duplication. Macrocosm, the cosmos. Microcosm, the little cosmos of the psyche. Mesocosm, the in-between cosmos of the society. The society imitated the forms of the mathematical movements of the cosmos. These were regarded as precisely the forms that move the psyche of the individual. You have a harmony here. So that by studying the stars, you learn the laws of society. By studying the laws of the society, you learn the laws of the individual. What do we have today? We know that the physics of the cosmos are not the laws that govern society. There's another plane of law here. We know also that the laws that govern society are not the laws of the individual psyche. So that those goods which an individual experiences and knows to be goods for his psyche, true for him, valid for him, he must not interpret in terms of a categorical imperative as the laws which ought to be the laws for all mankind or even for his own neighbors. Objectively, to study the laws by which a society may be governed, they are optional, they are conventional, they are not absolute. The laws by which my psyche is to develop are not those for yours or yours. They're different. And neither the psyche nor the society is governed by the laws that govern the stars, and we don't even know what those laws are. The whole thing has split. These wonderful three, cosmological, sociological, psychological, which in the old systems were one united unit, are now apart from each other. And we've got to learn, not only learn, but learn how to render in these communicating media of the symbolic world the mystery of this disintegration of what for the old monumental world was one great mystery. Well, so much for my little talk, really. The moonwalk has done it. Formally, this other perspective, the laws of Earth up there on the moon, and none of these having anything to do with the laws of pure psychology or sociology. This is the base out of which the symbolic heritage of the old myths, which are interpreted in these cosmological and sociological ways, have to be reread. Let's think in closing of some of the images that our youngsters have in mind, and we ourselves. Cosmology, space voyages. Just think of it. You're not just walking down the stream, or down to the stream. You're not just going from one town to another. You're going from the Earth to the moon and back. It's a commutation now already. They've done it three times. The sociological situation, a pell-mell of inbuilt heritages. In a single city, we have Catholics, we have Protestants, we have Jews, we have people from Oriental culture backgrounds. We now have big communities of Buddhists, for instance, in Hawaii. The simple saying on our money, "In God we trust." Well, suppose you don't have a God. There's no God in Buddhism. Well, there's a whole second-class citizen situation right there. When you pass the coin, you don't trust God at all. You trust your own imminent mother light. With respect to the individual and the God idea, Jung has noticed in the symbols coming from the dreams of his patients that, and he uses this, and I think many of you know, the symbolism of the mandala, the cosmic circle as a psychological device, where in the old traditional mandalas there would be a symbol of a god, there tends to turn up in his patients' mandalas the human symbol. Not a god, but humanity as the prime center of concern. Tillich coined the wonderful term, God is your ultimate concern. What the individual can find in himself through watching his life, through thinking about his life, and through other symptoms, what he can find in himself to be actually his ultimate concern, that is his God. If it is your child, and I dare say for many, the child is the ultimate concern, that child is your, what the Indians would call Ishtadevata, your chosen deity. It is the vehicle of your relationship to the divine principle. Your relationship to that little creature is your relationship to God, to your actual God. The theoretical God of the church is not operating in you. This relativism with respect to the God image is very important in our time. And now to conclude, I always think of Spengler when I look at what's going on in the world today. I became acquainted with Spengler some 40 years ago, and it was in those days a great shock what he had to say. What he had to say was that the momentum of our culture, the culture period of creativity, prime creativity, what he called the North European or Faustian culture symbolized in the Gothic cathedrals, in the Baroque palaces and so forth, has reached its apogee. And it is going into what he called civilization. We are actually, in his judgment, at that point of transition from culture to civilization, which the ancient world of Rome and Greece arrived at the time of the Carthaginian Wars, where the period of Greece was gone and the period of Rome comes in. The great mass culture, the hard fist of Caesarism and so forth, what the people want is simply bread and circuses and the authority of a strong fist against a formless mass. According to him, we are moving into that. With respect to the arts, one is taking down the culture forms. They no longer serve. They seem to be inhibiting us, throwing them out. And in the arts, more violence, no more the sensitive thing. Well, when one heard that 40 years ago, it didn't seem likely, but as one has watched, it is what is happening. Now, one can feel negatively about this, but one should not feel negatively about anything going on. You've got to grab it and move into it and note the positive thing. And so, not only are the culture forms being taken down, but the civilization forms are being found and built, which will be the guiding forms of the next 500-600 years, the last years, perhaps, of our civilization. Then I think in relation to this, also, of the further word of Leo Frobenius, who was a contemporary of Spengler's, and they worked a little bit in relationship to each other, namely, that the culture forms of the high traditions are now no longer possible. There will not be a new, independent, horizon-bound culture. We now have this global world. And we have moved from the whole world of monumental culture, which starts back in those ziggurats of 3500 BC. We've moved from that to a totally new world of mechanism, not monumentality. Mechanism, intercommunications, and you can see it in what's happened just as a result of the air service. You can go from here to India in less than 2 days. Whereas when you read the accounts of the Chinese voyagers leaving Chang'an to go to India to visit the Buddhist shrines there, it took them 7 years just to get to India over a dangerous, dangerous country. No separations anymore. And then such novelties as the atom bomb, which gives people a sense of fear of death. And then they get in their cars and drive 80 miles an hour unafraid of death and smash up on a lamppost long before the atom bomb has come along. This theoretical fear of death that comes from fearing the atom bomb seems to have nothing to do with the actualities of life. This is a mythological problem to face. Next, with respect to moral life, the wonderful pill. This has changed everything within 5 years in the way of the relationship of the sexes to each other. And finally, when I hear of a new city being built under the sea just outside of Kobe, Japan, and of dolphins being used as mailmen to bring the messages down. I think we're really coming into something that leaves the old myths pretty far behind. So with that, I offer a kind of prospect, and we can pause for a little while and think things over, or just smoke cigarettes or something. Then I'll ask for your questions and try to reply. And I want now to try to get in touch with your concerns, what you're interested in. And tonight I'll go back and meditate on those and bring you a more relevant lecture tomorrow morning.
I've been looking at our life here at Esalen
and the life that's lived here in Big Sur. From the point of view of return to that primitive affirmation of nature, of that prime force, and a desire in our rituals to return to an older mythology, or to a mythology that we can feel close to, not seeing a new and emerging, or not able to formulate one, but knowing that there is a need for that, and almost finding that certain times of the year, things spontaneously occur out of our collective unconscious. A bathing ritual in the spring, in the baths, which we bathed 75 people on a Saturday afternoon. Mm-hmm. It just happened. Some of the drumming by fire in the mountains, mirror ceremonies and fire ceremonies. The return to that primitive, affirmative, affirmation of the life force. And I just, I hear the last part of your talk, and I see the whole, the culture, the civilization moving far out in a different direction. And I wonder, where are we in relation to, Spengler said become an engineer.
Mm-hmm. Lay down the pen and pick up the monkey wrench, says Spengler.
Yeah, we're planting gardens and going on Indian, American Indian trips. And I really hear what you're saying.
Well, I've had a good opportunity in my own city, namely New York, to observe the phenomenology of the new movements, because I live right down in Greenwich Village and on 2nd Avenue and 7th Street, where my wife teaches, there's the whole show. It's easy to treat it in a light or rejecting way, but it has always seemed to me that our society just does not afford the individual the play in its traditions that is now necessary for people to find themselves. We ask people to find themselves. So this is exactly those ages of transition. They're a little late because everything's delayed in our culture. Particularly if you go through for a PhD, you're still under authority until you're about 45 years old, and you never get out of it. And some of these, I won't say too much about my members of my profession, but it's not an edifying spectacle. The business of playing a role is so important for finding yourself. And the impression I have very often coming back from Gene's New York University studio home, walking along that crazy street where the electric circus exists and several other things of that sort, and usually there's a swarm coming in gay rapture, everyone dressed up as though it were a carnival time, which it is, and which it should be. And since all of life is actually playing a role, and if you don't realize you're playing a role, you are a stuffed shirt. Whatever the game is you're playing, it is your game that you're playing for the world. Well, now for a certain period of time, you play this game of being the world's clown, or the one who fell out of the boat and is enjoying being out of the boat. And everybody trying to fish you back, and you say, wait, I'm liking this. You see, gradually the initiation, because this is a self-imposed initiation, and you've imposed upon yourself the cosmological game, Well, most of them are not imitating cosmic forces, but earlier social principles. This is the game. This is the game. Now, some are going to get stuck. One of the less fortunate things about self-directed initiations is that a majority are fiascos. That nature is extremely lavish. It produces thousands of mice so the two can survive, you know? And this, we're now in the lap of nature. Society isn't helping very much in this transitional thing. And many of these experiments are going to produce just cut and dried squares in about 10 years when the children that they have spontaneously produced begin to have certain claims which require certain financial support, that you're back in the box and you didn't achieve your hero life. But this is the great experiment, and I see it as such. It's the wonderful wilderness, and not everyone gets to the castle of the Grail, but they're on the way, and in that sense, laudable. There is another aspect of this, however, that is a little less exhilarating to me, and that is a kind of monotony in what people find to do. There's certain, and I mentioned it to a couple of my friends recently, they come from New York, you go to San Francisco, I just come back from Honolulu, and it's exactly the same routine. So that in that sense, it's not so darned individual. I'm saying in many cases. In other cases, it is. Our society is built by, and you might say almost for, people of a certain psychological trend. They flourish in this. They're not to be despised. They're finding that their hero work. And I think those men that turned up on the moon, you can't beat that. Not everyone runs that direction, and there's a great, it's a wonderful destiny to have a personal destiny that's not the same as that of your society. And it's one of the grand things of our society that there's room for that kind of kicking around. There were very few societies allowed it. There were very few. Jung uses the term persona, mask worn by an actor, to typify the role you play in society. And if you become identified with the role, let's say identify yourself with the role, then you're lost. If a person's playing cowboy, it's wonderful, but if he thinks he's a cowboy and he doesn't know what to do with the rear end of a horse, you don't have a very edifying adventure. Yes, sir, please.
My personal sentiment in terms of what I would like to see come down this week is just to get in touch with our own mythology and with other mythologies, just to get a sense of the way we're fooling ourselves in this whole cosmic.
Well, thank you. That's great. Now, let me just say a word about this, our own mythology. I'm always asked, what is the coming mythology? And I've thought about this, and I have no authority to give the answer. But it just seems to me that with this situation that I've been talking about here, of each one his own master, of self-responsible judgment, we're not going to have a mythology. We are going to have individual mythologies, little cluster mythologies, people of similar readinesses who get together and are helping each other, and that's what I see right here in Esalen. That's what I see in many, many places, where the groups spontaneously are each other's gurus or bodhisattvas. And so there will be many, many, many. On the other hand, there will be certain traits that will be in common. And those were some of the things I was trying to indicate when I spoke of the moonwalk. We all now have that. We can't make believe it didn't happen. I love to see people playing Indian, but you don't have the problems the Indians have. And what the Indian means to you is what the Indian means to the Indian. And you're not facing the difficulties he's facing. Finally, you write to Dad and you get the check. Or somebody does give you a lift down the road. It's a different world. So one's play at these roles has a quite different value from the actuality of the role that you are imitating. And if you realize that and use it as a reflect, you could speak of mythology. Shakespeare speaks of art as a mirror held up to nature. Mythology is a mirror held up to nature. But it's not just a gross mirror on the wall showing you that thing which you've known about all the while. It's a kind of X-ray mirror that opens up the form principle within you. And it's out of your dreams that you bring your myths. Now, with respect to the dream, this is something I want to talk about in the course of our week. Perhaps come up and around in different ways. There are aspects of dreams that are completely personal. A person tells you his dream, you don't know anything about the person, what kinds of things have worked in his life, there's nothing you can do with it except ask the person, well, what do you think it means? On the other hand, there are dreams that immediately sound like myths. One finds oneself recognizing them. These are the things that are linked to the great heritage of mythology. How does they get in the person and so forth? We'll have to talk about that and think about that a little bit in a number, I think, of our later sessions.
In talking about the individual expressing a myth that is also collectively applicable, can you look at it the opposite way, which Jung did very much, about a collective myth very much representing the individual myth? In other words, a collective unconscious. You talked about myths being projections, but very possibly projecting not only immediate concerns of society, but also projecting very deep psychic processes that are very common throughout a very large segment of time throughout human civilization. And I'm very interested in how you can relate even a very ancient myth or a Navajo myth or an Indian myth or whatever to the individual now, today, and really see it, those symbols moving now, today. Mm-hmm. I think it works.
That's a way of saying what I would regard as our main problem. For Jung, well, now let me just very briefly say something about this dream and mythology. When one reads Freud, one has one's reading of an unconscious that is based on conscious experiences which have become unconscious. The experiences of infancy and childhood that have been forgotten, rejected, repressed are the principal concern of the Freudian analysis. These are biographical. The mythology, the dream imagery that Freud is interpreting and his mode of interpretation has to do with the biography of the individual. And also when he turns to history, for example, in those two great works, The Totem and Taboo and The Moses and Monotheism, he interprets the mythology as the consequence of historical events. In the beginning was the deed. You remember he says at the close of The Totem and Taboo, the killing of the father did take place. And hence it is in the myths. The Jews did kill Moses, hence this agony of ambivalence with respect to the imagery of the God of Moses and so forth and so on. Now in Jung, on the other hand, we find besides that level of the individual biography, which he calls the personal unconscious, that aspect of your system of images, which is dependent for its existence on the actual experiences of your personal life. Besides that, we have a level of the unconscious that is based on the common physical heritage of human beings. We all have the same body. There are the organs of movement, there are the organs of thought, there are the organs of generation, there are the organs of digestion and so forth. All of these moving toward their actions. And many of these actions are in conflict with each other. The impulse to aggression and the impulse to love, these are often in interplay. Also the experience of daylight life and then night experience and dream. These are two worlds. All human beings have these. So there is a general common base, and that was what he was talking about as the collective unconscious. But this common base becomes differently inflected in different culture periods and different culture milieu. So there is a kind of ethnic unconscious also. That is one of the difficulties in reading Jung. He would write and then become aware of some of the implications of what he had written, and his language would change a little bit. So that Jung represents in his writings the history of Jung's development of his theory. Freud's theory developed in much more sudden jumps. Jung's jumped very slowly. And so when he speaks about collective unconscious, he really means two things, and he says so later on. He means, on the one hand, the collectivity of impulse and concern of all human beings, because they all have the same human body. And on the other hand, the collectivity of a given culture heritage. He points out, for instance, the difference between the mythological mode of the Jewish tradition and the mythological mode of the traditions of the nations around the Hebrew race at the time of the coming into the flower of the Hebrew tradition. Those are ethnic communities. We have a basic human community. When he speaks about the race, he means the human race, and then we have the ethnic communities as well. Now, all of us inherit an ethnic background, and that rides behind our experiences also. There's simply no doubt about it. The way in which a Hindu experiences his personal life is very, very different from the way in which, let's say, a Unitarian or a Jew or a Catholic would experience things. So we have to reckon these various racial backgrounds as well as our personal experiences and the deep common human thing. All this is what I hope we can be talking about here. Anyone else have questions?
I'd be interested in exploring some of the details of the way in which a patriarchal mythology overtook a matriarchal mythology.
Oh, fine. That's a wonderful theme, and it's one that underlies all of the high culture mythologies of the ancient world. There is all, behind all of them, a matriarchal base that is associated with the Neolithic. And this is becoming clearer and clearer and clearer. And then with the invading hunting tribes and herding tribes, the Mongols, the Aryan and Semitic peoples, patriarchal mythologies superimpose themselves over the matriarchal and transpose the symbols. There's no better body of evidence for this than the backgrounds and character of the biblical tradition. It's a very interesting thing. That serpent in the garden, who is cursed by Yahweh, was the God who built the garden, and this we know. It was Ninguzida, the great deity of the old Sumero-Babylonian tradition. And that garden, you can see it in the Sumerian seals all over the place. And this new arrival comes in and says, the garden is mine. And total transformation. Mother is down, Papa is up. And there's a very amusing thing that Kramer brought forth. Samuel Noah Kramer is the principal translator of the Sumerian texts in our English tradition. The tradition of the English translations. He found a text from ancient Sumer where an agriculturalist and a shepherd were contending for the grace and approval of the goddess. And the herder with his sheep and goats told of all the fine things he could give the goddess, cheese and lovely stews and things like that. And the agriculturalist told the goddess all the wonderful things he could give her. And whom did she choose? The agriculturalist. So then we come over a little over a millennium later to Cain and Abel making the same bid for the approval of Papa, not Mama. And Cain, the agriculturalist, gets the dirty end of the stick. The Papa says, oh, I like the herder. Because the Hebrews had been herders, not agriculturalists. Cain was the representative of the cities that were invaded, of the land-based agricultural societies. So, to put Cain still further in the wrong, we have him murder the good boy, and then we have this story, Cain and Abel, which is a complete reversal of a little tradition for which we have the text about 1,000 or so years earlier. When you interpret a myth in terms that the intellect has decided would be prudent, the unconscious is nevertheless interpreting the myth in its original message. And this is one of the confusing things about our culture. We are being told that this is the real sense of life, and our unconscious is saying, no, no. No, 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 this is not it at all. So the messages get become garbled right in the way they are driven into it.
Well, I was thinking in terms of that feud for whether the mother or the father would be the, you know, to who you pray to, and who would be on top, as it were. That has not yet been decided.
Well, it's got to be decided for each one for himself. Some prefer Mama, some prefer Papa. And the very nice thing about the Catholic tradition is, when you go in, there's Jesus with his, as Bloom says, and Ulysses with his heart on his sleeve, on one side of the altar, and the other, Mother there with her blue gown and her hands out in the boon-bestowing posture. Come to me, my dear.